unfulfilled procedure anything that we refer back to us, but that hasn't happened. But informally we're in touch with the speaker following the thing up. So if they refer back to us formally, then we'll engage it. But at the moment we are acting on it, and the committee will be kept informed. Before the end of this week, I believe the particular candidate should be here tomorrow. So just briefly, myself and the speaker will talk to the person, find out what is the story and all this. Then we'll... Yeah, we're hoping so. We're trying to get them in. No. I think that's understood. When Ali is saying the matter is not coming to the committee, I'm saying, no, it will be referred for money. But I think it's important for members to be informed of what you have done. Yeah. So there is the issue of the way things happened. I mean, you weren't here that week. You were at the JSC. Yeah. But and unfortunately, the member raised that is not here. But I think it was unfortunate that the matter had to be raised in plenary at the stage we were about to vote. And if we had that information beforehand, we could have looked at what to do with it. I mean, maybe we should wait until the relevant member is here. But it just... and she's a new member of Parliament anyway, but it just would have helped if things could have been done differently.
May I just contribute? I don't wish to speak on behalf of a member who belongs to another party, but my understanding is that she didn't have that information until she literally found it between the conclusion of our work and the plenary, but she will answer herself.
It may be, well, I'm sure, yeah, one would hope in her favor that the she didn't have the information when Advocate Mpumlwana was being interviewed, but if she had approached us before the plenary, presumably she didn't get the information a minute before the plenary. If she'd approached us before the plenary, we could have had a meeting to discuss how to handle it and what to do. That's the point I'm making, but I think it should maybe wait until she's here. But I'm raising it from a point of view of things in future, rather than what's happened.
Thank you very much. We are not amending the agenda, as I understand. We proceed with the presentation. Are there any apologies? No. Apologies, yeah.
Honorable Sibanyoni for the journey of late. An apology from Honorable Swart and from Honorable Adams.
Okay. Thank you.
I've got subcommittee on joint rules. Maybe there is that. I may go between
them. Enough, tell them so can. So, number three on the bill. That's a traditional courts bill way forward. Our sense, I don't know if we want to skip this for now and deal with it later. Start with the presentation on protection of personal information bill. We'll later when it comes back to number, that's number three. I can, as we pass it, to say there's no way we're going to finish this bill this year. This traditional courts bill, no way. So we're going to have to be discussing what we do with section whatever of 1929 and so on. That one. Possibly extending it. Because it's complicated, this bill. It's very complicated. It means that really, really, we've got to go into it very slowly. We can run into landmines, and I don't want further landmines in my committee beyond this one that we are just going through. Okay, so Google, that's where I end up.
No, I think you have resolved the question by saying, since it's more an internal matter,
It's good to make it, put it at last.
Good. Let's go to number four, briefing on protection of personal information bills. Please, where you are.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've previously introduced myself to the committee, but just for record purposes, my name is Dion Ladman. I'm the Deputy DG responsible for legislation in the Department of Justice. I would also like to introduce my colleagues that will do the briefing to you this morning. On my left-hand side is Ananda Lowe. She is a principal state law advisor and researcher, senior researcher at the South African Law Reform Commission. And she was the researcher responsible for the report that you have in front of you. The report is the Privacy and Data Protection Report of the South African Law Reform Commission. We have made this document available to the committee. I hope that you all have copies. Chair, and then on my right is Mr. Henk de Preer. He is a senior state law advisor in the Chief Directorate Legislative Development, and from the department side, he is the person responsible for the bill now before the committee. Chair, as I've indicated, the bill is a product of the of an investigation of the South African Law Reform Commission. It was introduced into Parliament on the 25th of August this year. We have also provided you with a briefing document, Chair. This document contains the information that will be presented to you this morning, the contents of the bill. And the briefing this morning, firstly, Chair, I will ask Henk to give you just a brief history of where the bill comes from, where the investigation of the Law Reform Commission comes from. Thereafter, Ananda will look at the investigation itself. She will explain to you what the different phases of the investigation were, the parties that were consulted, the whole process that was followed by the South African Law Reform Commission to arrive at the bill that they presented to the Minister of Justice. She will also explain some of the principles underpinning the bill. And then thereafter, Chair, finally, Henk will give you a briefing on the bill itself, on the clauses, the general, the provisions of the bill itself. And I apologize, we also have one of the state law advisors here working under Advocate Enver Daniels, Mr. Makabeni. Sisap Makabeni is also here. So with your permission, Chair, firstly, I will ask Henk to give you a just a general introduction, or a brief history of where the investigation and the bill originates from. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, in advance, I would like to apologize. We are going to bore you because we have a lot of work to do. This is a very big bill. It's going to take us time, so we would request your indulgence and your patience with us, especially when we go into the bill itself. There are various clauses that we would like to take our time on and try and explain them as properly as possible to you. But in any event, Mr. Chair, if I may, Section 32 of the Constitution provides for the right of access to information. It also required national legislation to be enacted. In 1999, Parliament established the Ad Hoc Joint Committee on the Open Democracy Bill. There are some of your members present here who also served on that committee. The Open Democracy Bill that was submitted or introduced into Parliament contained primarily provisions dealing with the right of access to information, but it also contains provisions dealing with, or draft provisions dealing with, whistleblower protection, and then also a few provisions dealing with the right to privacy. Parliament, however, or the Ad Hoc Joint Committee, when it reported the bill to Parliament, advised that the Open Democracy Bill fell short to a certain extent with regard to the right to privacy because it did not regulate matters such as the protection and control, correction, etc., cetera, of personal information. At that stage, Parliament requested that the minister should investigate or request the South African Law Reform Commission to investigate the matter for us. And after that, at the conclusion of that investigation, the minister was requested to introduce legislation. So I think the first important aspect that we would like to advise at this stage is that Parliament specifically requested for this legislation. The Ad Hoc Joint Committee in its report also indicated that where there is access to information legislation in other countries, those countries also opted to enact separate what we generally refer to at that stage as privacy and data protection legislation. Maybe just to be complete, with regard to the draft provisions that were contained in the Open Democracy Bill that dealt with the protection of whistleblowers, a separate piece of legislation was enacted later during that year in 2000, which eventually ended up as the Protected Disclosures Act, Act 26 of 2000. So to a certain extent, what flowed from the Open Democracy Bill and what we have here today is the final component of what Parliament looked at in 1999 and briefly in 2000. Mr. Chair, yes, with your permission, just with that brief background information as far as trying or attempting to give you an indication where we actually started with the whole process, I would like to hand over to Ms. Ananda Lowe. As Mr. Ratman indicated, I think it's also important for us, and please indulge us, if we could explain to you how the investigation of the South African Law Reform Commission developed. And then secondly, Ms. Ananda Lowe is also going to provide us with an indication of the legislative framework as it exists in other countries. This is extremely important, and as soon as we get to the provisions of the bill, you will note that to a certain extent, especially where we are going to look at an aspect like adequacy requirements, etc., that it's important for us to be in line with international legislation in this regard. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would like to request Ms. Ananda Lowe now to proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Inc. As Inc has said, I'm going to look at four different aspects. First of all, I will look at the process followed, and then more, I'm going to address the substance. I'm going to look at the right to privacy and where the protection of personal information really comes in. Thirdly, I will look at the international position, and then I will conclude with the question, why do we need this legislation? What is the reason for having this legislation? So first of all, let's look at the process. You've already heard we were requested by the minister to include this investigation in our program. The investigation really started with the appointment by the minister of a project committee. It was under the chairpersonship of Judge Craig Howie, who was at the time the president of the appeal court. There were 10 other members, and they were all experts in their various fields. So we had academics who were really interested in that field and working in that field. For example, Professor Johan Netling, who is actually the expert in the field of privacy, who's written a lot of textbooks on it and so forth. We also had members from the informal sector, NGOs, also from business, both direct marketing, insurance, banking industry. So we felt that it was also possible for them in the various committee meetings to give their input and to provide us with their expertise from their specific sectors, which I think was a very important part of the whole process. We started by publishing an issue paper. That was in 2003, later on a discussion paper in 2005, and eventually the report was finalized in December and submitted to the minister in February. In between the point of the issue papers were really to for people to be able to see what was the work that we were doing. In the issue paper, we just explained all the problem areas and we tried to identify stakeholders and ask for written submissions on the whole issue, which we received. With the discussion paper, we already had a draft bill, and that draft bill was circulated very widely, and people were then asked to specifically comment on the technical detail of the bill. We also, and in the report, everything was, of course, you know, all the recommendations were made, as the final recommendations of the commission were made. In between those discussions, after the issue paper, as well as after the discussion paper, we had very intensive consultation periods. With the issue paper, of course, that was more regarding the reason for the legislation, why it was necessary to have this legislation, whether it was necessary to have it, whether we should have separate legislation, etc. And we had a informal discussions on that, which received a very wide response in written submissions, and those were collated and included in the discussion paper. After the discussion paper, we started with serious workshopping. We had workshops across the country, specifically dealing with the legislation. And we also had sector-specific meetings. I think that was very important in the sense that we actually, at the workshops, we identified the problems that people had, and then we honed in on those problems in the sector-specific meetings. It's very, the bill will be applicable to both the private sector and government. So insofar as government is concerned, we, of course, received written submissions from all the government departments, and we had discussions with them. But I would like to mention specifically a few government departments who were really, we really honed in on because of the fact that they were also busy with legislation of their own in their own departments. And those were, first of all, the Department of Communications, when they enacted the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act. We had a series of protracted consultations with them. And that resulted in the ECT Act at that stage, some of the sections in that act being removed, and the I think it was Section 50 and 51 included on a voluntary basis. So we sorted that out in that sense, and it was meant as an interim arrangement. The same happened with the DTI insofar as the National Credit Act was concerned, and also I think right at the start, I should have mentioned that first, of course, was FIRE, when this, I think what Link has referred to when that the position there was clarified. We also worked with the Ministry of National Intelligence insofar as the Protection of Information Bill at that stage were concerned, and we also came to an agreement as to how the two pieces of legislation would work together. Perhaps we can talk about that later again. So it was really protracted and in-depth consultations, which actually led to other pieces of legislation being harmonized with this piece of legislation. In the private sector, of course, we had also discussions with everybody. I had you know, numerous discussions. We were completely transparent and open, and people contacted us on a regular basis. I had regular meetings every week with people from the private sector. But there also I would specifically like to mention the Direct Marketing Association, because I think that after the discussion paper, we realized that stricter measures would be necessary for the direct marketers, and it would definitely impact on their business quite a lot. So it was necessary to come to some sort of agreement. Of course, they were not happy in the, at the start of the negotiations, but I think they realized as we went along, and we tried to investigate all avenues, all suggestions that they came with, you know, and they realized that the position as we had set it out in the bill was really the international position, and that, for instance, the direct marketing associations in other countries were also subject to the same set of rules, and they came to accept it, although I'm sure they're not happy about it, but they came to accept the position as it is at the moment. We also had a lot of discussions with the Credit Bureau Association, the Banking Association. As I mentioned, we had representatives on our committee as well from those sectors. And so it went on for quite a long time. What we did also was to It was the workshops, the sector-specific meetings, individual meetings with people, as well as the written submissions that were collated and included in our final report. So all in all, I think I can really honestly say that this has been a completely transparent process, that we've been available at all times during the 5 years that we really worked on this bill, and that we've had a good relationship with most of the sectors, all of the sectors really, and that I'm hoping that they would be, not if they're not happy, that they will accept the way in which the bill was. Of course, there are always detail, and we accept that there will still be, you know, submissions made and that there will still be changes made to the legislation, but in principle, I think I'm quite happy to say that it was a very comprehensive consultation process that we followed. Okay, so that is more or less insofar as the report is concerned. The report was submitted in February, and we're very happy to be here to be able to submit it to Parliament now. Insofar as the substance is concerned, I'm just going to look at the right to privacy and just give you a little bit of background as to where this protection of personal information really comes from. First of all, it's important to know that the right to privacy is protected in both our common law and the Constitution. And that the courts therefore have an obligation to develop the common law in accordance with the spirit, objects, and purport of the Bill of Rights. It is important to know that privacy, the right to privacy, was not always regarded as an independent right. It was sometimes thought that it was part of the concept of dignity or identity or things like that. Of course, there is the argument that dignity always under rights, all the rights in the Constitution. But you will see, if I explain it to you, what I mean about privacy being an independent right. First of all, in Section 14, it really confirmed the fact that the right to dignity was a separate right, an independent right that had to be protected. And what is important in that sense is that the question whether insult should be an element of this right. And it was then confirmed by the court in the court that is not the fact, that the right to privacy is in fact a right on its own, and that it can be distinguished from the right to identity and the right to dignity, where different aspects are added really to the right to privacy. So, if you infringe a person's privacy, it is not always necessary to also infringe his identity or infringe his dignity, although it can often happen, but it's not a prerequisite. Important court case is that of Mystery versus the Interim Medical and Dental Council of South Africa. In this constitutional court case, it was said that even though the breach of information privacy was not expressly mentioned in Section 13, that was, of course, in the interim constitution, now Section 14, it would be, in fact, be covered by the broad protection of the right to privacy guaranteed by that section. So although if you read Section 14, it will say everyone has the right to privacy, which includes the right not to have, and then four aspects are mentioned. And information privacy is not strictly one of the four. It should be read in as part of the first general guarantee of the right to privacy. So everyone has the right to privacy, and then it includes the following rights. But the right to information privacy has been included by the Constitutional Court in the Mystery case, specifically mentioning it. Also interesting to note is, for instance, Bernstein versus Bester, the case of where Judge Ackerman said that the nature of privacy implicated by the right to privacy relates only to the most personal aspects of a person's existence and not to every aspect within his or her personal knowledge and experience. Now, some people during the investigation thought that that was a good enough reason for excluding a lot of personal information if it's not in the really most personal aspect of a person's existence, and that may be a good argument. However, one must also look at the Hyundai case, which was later investigating directed serious economic offenses versus Hyundai motor distributors, in which Judge Langer said that the right to privacy should not be understood to mean that persons no longer retain such a right in the social capacities in which they act. Thus, when people are in their offices, in their cars, or on mobile telephones, they still retain a right to be left alone by the state unless certain conditions are satisfied. So it was broadened. The right was again broadened to include all kinds of personal information, not only those which is in the narrower sense. What is very important to know is that the right of privacy is not absolute. As a common law right of personality, it is always necessary to limit the legitimate interests of others by the legitimate interests of others and the public interest. And I think if you look at this legislation, you will see that it is really an example of the balancing act that has happened between the right of access to information and the right to privacy. That is really the hallmark of this legislation, is the whole balancing act that has taken place. Because it is absolutely necessary to find that fine balance between the data subject from the fundamental right to privacy, as set out in Section 14 on the one hand, and on the other, a person's legitimate need to obtain information about the data subject. And that is really what we've tried to do in this legislation. The infringement is exactly the same. The essentials for liability is the same as the actio injuriorum that you find in the common law, the impairment of the privacy, wrongfulness, intention, and intention. And you will see, if you read our report, you will see how the Constitutional Court and the common law sort of merges in this sense. Just on a practical note, I think there are quite a few misconceptions that I would right at the beginning try to dispense with. First of all, the idea that privacy is the right to be left alone. You know, if you're old enough, you will know that Garbo said, "I want to be alone." You know, so that's not what privacy is about. Privacy is really the right to control personal information after disclosure to others. And that's very important, because it's when you disclose your information, you must still keep control over it. That's the idea of the bill. It's not that you must keep everything private or so. The second one is that privacy is an obstacle to overcome. And we've really tried to explain that to business as well and to government as well. It's a design objective. If you include it in your whole process from the start, you will have a better process in the end. It is really good business practice. So if you see that as part of how you are going to serve the citizen, if you're the government, or the consumer, if you're the private body, that is really going to be to your advantage. It will enhance your image and the operations of your undertaking. And then the last thing that's also very important, sometimes people think that privacy will stem the flow of information. And that is not true, and you will see when I talk about the international situation, it is actually going to enhance the free flow of information, especially across borders. So that's insofar as the theoretical background to the whole act is concerned. I think I'm quickly going to show you a PowerPoint presentation, and that will be, I think it will be interesting for you, so just bear with me. I'm just going to move to my computer. I hope I'm going to manage this.
Oh, this is the big one.
Okay, just to say that it wasn't totally pigeonholed, things was inadvertent. Yeah, the big one.
Did you have a joyous day in Lanai? That's good. We're ready for you, if you are ready.
Okay, we're going to just have a quick look at the international perspective, because it's an important part of the bill. You know, it was very, what happened was really in the 1960s, more or less, there was a worldwide expansion of telecommunications technology. That meant big computers, the whole internet, and all of that happened. And what is important to know is that the protection, the idea of protecting information is not a new idea. It is really, what we are really aiming to do is to give people the same protection that they had 50 years ago. 50 years ago, you had a paper file, and it was put in a cupboard and in a room, locked away. It was difficult to access that information, and it was also difficult to distribute it. Today, it's extremely easy because it's on a laptop computer. It may be lying on the coffee table in the coffee shop where you are having coffee with friends. And one has to ask the question, why are you not giving people the same protection that you used to give them where their personal and especially sensitive information is concerned? So it is the rules, the idea has not changed. It is the environment that has changed, and that is why we need new rules to give the same protection that we used to give 50 years ago. Now, this is not a domestic policy problem. It is a problem worldwide, and especially around about the 60s, 70s, this really became a big problem, and people across the world tried to address this problem. Now, what happened is that each country just went about it in their own way, and they dealt with it as good as best as they could, which meant that each country had a different set of rules, more or less the same in the same vein, but it was different. So what happened was that there were two big organizations, the Council of Europe on the one hand and the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development on the other hand, which really tried to address this in a more holistic fashion. I'm going to come back to the others. You will see there's the COE Convention, that's the Council of Europe, that I just referred to, Convention, and then the OECD guidelines. There were others as well, and also newer ones. For instance, APEC is the Asia-Pacific organization that is trying to deal with it in the countries around the Pacific Ocean. The Commonwealth also tried to deal with it. United Nations deals with it. And there are also international privacy frameworks and standards that people are trying to deal with it. But I'm going to – so these are all the different institutions worldwide that try to deal with this problem, and they all came more or less to the same conclusion. But I'm specifically going to look at the Council of Europe and the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development because they were the main role players, and they influenced the national legislation in most countries around the world. What was interesting about them was that the Council of Europe, if you look at the Council of Europe's objectives, they were to create a common democratic and legal area throughout the whole of the continent, that's Europe, ensuring respect for its fundamental values, human rights, democracy, and the rule of law. Now, those words in blue are the important ones, human rights, democracy, and rule of law. That was really the European perspective, and there are certain reasons why Europe, specifically coming from the world wars, had this sort of view of the protection of information. On the other hand, you have the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Their objectives were to achieve the highest sustainable economic growth and employment, a rising standard of living, financial stability, development of the world economy, economic expansion, economic development, expansion of world trade. Now, it's immediately obvious that the two organizations have completely different objectives, but they were looking at the same problem. And what was very interesting about this is that although the one was coming from a completely economic viewpoint and the other from a human rights viewpoint, they actually came together and they had exactly the same. The ideas were exactly the same. They came to the same conclusion. Now, before we get to the conclusion, let's look at who the member countries was. Of course, the Council of Europe were all the European countries. The OECD were also the European countries, but they included countries like the United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, and Korea. And usually, because of the fact, when you're talking about personal information, because of the fact that the European countries are subject to such strict rules, usually when we talk about the OECD countries, we actually refer to United States, Canada, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Mexico, because they come from that economic sphere. And you will see that how they interpreted these international instruments in their national legislation was really that there were consensus on the internationally accepted privacy principles. The laws in the European countries were influenced by the human rights perspective, whereas the laws in the countries outside of Europe, those America and the ones that I've referred to now, they were more influenced by economic imperatives. And what they all decided was that there were 8 information protection principles. Whether they came from completely different areas, they came from human rights perspective and from the economic perspective, they came together, and if you look at the, and in the back of your report, you will find both the EU directive and the OECD guidelines. And if you read through that, you will see that they are almost exactly the same. And they are very basic principles. They are sort of common sense minimum requirements. It says that information must be obtained fairly and lawfully. It must be used for the original purpose. It must not be used for any other purpose than the one specified in the beginning. It must be accurate and up-to-date. It must be adequate, relevant, and not excessive, processed openly, accessible to the subject, kept secure, and destroyed after the purpose is completed. And that's it. It's minimum requirements, really, and it is being regarded worldwide as good business practice. It is also generally accepted internationally in all the countries of the world. Now, we will get to the implementation and how it's being implemented in different countries. But I think right from the start, what you must realize is, irrespective of how you're going to implement it, in the end, everybody comes back to these principles. Because, you know, whether it's via contract or via legislation or informal arrangements or country agreements or whatever, they all come back to these principles and they are accepted worldwide and they are the same for everybody. So that is really very important for us as well. That is really what we try to do as well. Because what happened was that everything was going well. They were now all agreed on this, these 8 principles. And but what happened was that many of the countries that were not part of the EU or of the OECD and wanted to find loopholes for this legislation simply distributed the information to countries that were not part of this whole setup. So what happened in, like, for instance, countries like South Africa? What happened was that they were what they call data havens, and the information was then sent, because it was so easy to send information via computer, the whole data file was just sent to another country. It was processed there and then sent back after it's been processed to a country where no regulation was in effect. And the EU was not happy with that because of the fact that, you know, now the whole purpose of these this agreement was being circumscribed. So they said actually that they made a law, and that is the EU directive, and they said that no information from Europe may be sent to a country, first of all, that does not have adequate data protection freely. There are exceptions because you can't just stop the whole transfer of information immediately. But the freeze transfer of information over borders of information from Europe to another country is unlawful if that country is not does not have adequate data protection. And then they also said you're not allowed to send it also, secondly, to a country that sends information to a country that doesn't have adequate legislation. Because otherwise, it will be easy just to send it to a country, and then that country can send it for you to another country, and then the loophole will still be there. So it's a double bind. And that made it very difficult. I mean, America, for instance, was very upset about this whole thing. They felt that Europe was, and I think it was rightly so, they were imposing their own rules on the rest of the world. So there was a lot of friction in this regard between Europe and America about this whole thing, but it, in the end, actually, Europe got its way because they instituted a safe harbor agreement between the USA and EU, and in terms of that agreement, the every company that indicates its willingness to comply with the principles, these 8 principles that we've referred to, if they indicate their willingness to comply with those 8 information protection principles, their names are added to the safe harbor agreement, and then they are able to freely send information wherever they like. I must just mention that if you do not have adequate rating, a country doesn't have an adequate rating, then it is possible to have international relations where the information are supposed to be transferred if you have a contract specifically stipulating that you are willing to comply with those information protection principles. So there are ways to get around the problem if you do not have adequate privacy legislation in a country, but it makes it much more difficult because then you have to do this on a contract, per contract basis, and or per agreement, which makes it much more difficult. Whereas if a country has adequate data rating, then the information can flow easily from one person to the other. So that is very important. Let me just show you the data protection laws around the world. At the moment, there are comprehensive data protection laws in all the countries in blue. You will see America is not indicated as blue, and that is because of the fact that they have the Safe Harbor Agreement. They do have legislation for government entities. They do have a Privacy Act for government entities, but they do not have it for private companies, for the private sector, and therefore they are not indicated as blue, but they have a Safe Harbor Agreement. Interesting in life is that we are not the first country in Africa. Unfortunately, other countries have overtaken us, and there are already four countries in Africa that do have the data protection in, legislation, and they are Morocco, Burkina Faso, Senegal. Senegal was the first one, and I think I have the names here. Let me quickly have a look. Where are they now? I want to tell you who they are. There they are, Senegal, Morocco, Benin, and Burkina Faso. There are other countries in Africa that already have data privacy legislation. There are also a number of other countries in Africa that are starting out, discussing, looking at their data privacy legislation. Of course, the countries in the EU are very eager to assist countries in Africa because they would like the whole world, really, the legislation of the whole world to be harmonized, because that will in fact assist the free flow of information across the world, and of course it will also at the same time protect the human rights of individuals. What is important about the legislation, our legislation as well as legislation worldwide, is that it's principle based, and that is in fact then means that it is not rules-based. So if you have principle-based legislation, it means that you have an overarching framework. You're concerned about outcomes, not necessarily so much about the process. There is a compliance with the spirit of the law, and there's a lot of flexibility. Now, you have to understand that if you are trying to make legislation for every single government department as well as for every private entity in the country, then it must be flexible, and you cannot have rules, specify rules, because then your act will be 5,000 pages if you want to do that. So what has happened is that you take the principles and you use them as a guide, and they are complemented by regulations and especially by codes of conduct and official guidelines by the regulator. Now we're going to speak, Link is going to speak on this, the whole issue of codes of conduct, but I think just to get the sort of idea of how it works, how the legislation works, is that it's principle-based and it gives you the principles that you have to comply with, and then it is accompanied by regulations, codes of conduct, and sector-specific legislation. And all of that, if you take all of that together, then you get what is really the privacy framework for South Africa. So it's not only the bill is the basis, and all the other sector-specific pieces of legislation, as well as codes of conduct and regulation, will add to that, and that will really form the whole framework. Just to see what the information management life cycle really is, it starts with the collection of information. That is the most important point, because that is really where you have the contact with the data subject. We talk about data subjects on the one hand and responsible parties on the other hand. The data subject is the person whose information is being collected. The responsible party is the one collecting the information. Those will always be the two parties. Now, where you have the collection of the information is where those two really meet. Later on, the data subject may not be in control of the information anymore because it's being stored, used, distributed, archived, and eventually destructed. So the collection point is almost the most important point for the data subject and also for the responsible party. And you will see that there's lots of that's really the part that we regard in the legislation also as the most important part. When you want to see if any sort of system that you have or any sector-specific piece of legislation or whatever is adequate, there are three things that you must always look at. First of all, the whole information life cycle must be there. So you can't just start protecting the information when you start using it or you start distributing it or you start storing it. You have to make sure that all of the steps in the information cycle has actually been covered. That's the first thing. The second thing is then your checklist, all the principles, all eight principles must be covered. And thirdly, all the responsible parties must be covered. Because you will see in that cycle, it is not always the same responsible party that is collecting the information and the same one that's storing it. For instance, look at the health physician. You may go to your general practitioner. He may collect your information. He may send it to the specialist or to have your blood collected or whatever. A lot of other people may come into this cycle. And all of them will be responsible parties. They will all be keeping your information. Even the people that collect his debts may get your personal information, or the medical aid funds may get your information. So a lot of people will be in that life cycle who will actually, you will just go to the doctor on a Monday, but by Friday, you know, a lot of other responsible parties may also be involved in the process. So you have to include all of those responsible parties. You have to make sure that you cover the whole cycle, and you have to look at all the different principles. And the principles are looked at as a package deal. So you can't just look at one instance. Many people often just concentrate on the consent principle. This is not consent-driven legislation. You have to look at all the principles as a package deal. Okay, in conclusion, the PPI Bill is a hybrid piece of legislation incorporating both human rights perspectives while providing economic expediences. I think if you realize that right at the beginning, when you had the COE and you had the OECD, they were already balancing this before a single piece of legislation had been written. So they were already looking at this, and when they came up with their principles, they had already balanced the whole the two aspects of the problem. It is principle-based rather than rules-based legislation, and it will be read with specific legislation, regulations, codes of conduct, and guidelines. It emphasizes the do-the-right approach and promotes compliance with the spirit of the law. It is proactive legislation. It is not only there to police. It is really there to get systems in place. And although it's possible to learn from experiences in other jurisdictions, the law should primarily be interpreted with reference to the international instruments from which it originated. But it's very interesting to see what other countries have been doing, especially since we don't have to invent the wheel ourselves again. So that's it insofar as this is concerned.
Thank you very much. You want a break? You are asking questions.
Is it possible to ask, and what is the correct title, Ananda? Is it doctor? Or? Is Ms. still right? No, I just didn't want to. Yeah, Ivan. Is it possible to ask Ms. Lowe something now, which arises directly from this portion? Is that all right? Thank you. I think you draw a really neat differentiation between the European data directive and the American approach by calling the one human rights based and the other, the whole OECD regime, economically driven. However, it is surely also the case that the United States in particular, their whole approach rests not only on economic freedom but also free speech in its broadest application. Is that not right? Now, that being the case, I'd like to ask this. You've stipulated the eight principles that are universally applicable. And it goes without saying, as far as I'm concerned, that we need practically law of universal application. The World Wide Web is a worldwide application, and we have to have world laws. Now, to what degree have you stuck to the eight principles as the underlying foundation for this whole bill? To what degree have you
gone further than that and perhaps used the European ethic, especially since you say this is a principle-based law, rather than the American. It is, to me, one of the abiding questions, and I won't now bore you with all my views on the matter. But to what degree do we stick to the eight? To what degree do we go beyond that and take the broad rights approach of our what is, after all, our major trading partner, the EU, or used to be our major trading partner?
I think what is interesting in this whole issue is really that although they came from different viewpoints, they actually, the conclusion was the same. So I don't think it was really necessary for us to choose the one or the other, and I think it's really the balancing of the two that is important, because the way in which the privacy legislation is being dealt with in the US, in the end, in practice, is actually the same as the way in which it's being dealt with in Europe, although they are coming. That's what's so peculiar about this legislation, is that usually you would be, have that would be in opposition to each other. But this is actually one instance where I found that it's a win-win situation, because you're protecting the data subject, but at the same time, it is actually a good thing for business to do so, because you are, your consumer is able, and perhaps I should just come to the fourth part of my presentation here is still why do we need the legislation? And you will see that the consumer, if you look at it, it's just that they come from different viewpoints. It's not that they have different ways of interpreting it or different principles. They abide by the same principles. It is just in the way that they deal with it in practice that it's a little bit different, and I think that more or less comes from the sort of the idea that the US didn't like the idea that the EU was prescribing to them. So they sort of did it in a little bit a different way. But that's how the agreement and also the legislation that they have for the government departments are the same as everybody worldwide, because it has to be the same. Otherwise, because what happened was before they harmonized the legislation, it was really that you had to have lawyers in each country. Because if you want to send the information from 1, 2, 3 to fourth next country each time, you have to comply with a different set of rules. And that has been harmonized. So in the end, I don't think there's really that much of a difference between the end product, although they came from different perspectives in the beginning. So it wasn't a conflict for us to decide we're going to follow the European way. The only difference really is that in the implementation, we've decided to have one generic act instead of, if we had followed the American way of doing it, we would have had sector-specific pieces of legislation and we would have had agreements and, you know, it would have been more fractured. But the principles are exactly the same. The way that they implement is exactly the same. It's just that they don't have a generic act, and especially for the private sector, and they also do not have a regulator specifically implementing that generic act. But they do have the institutions in America, various institutions dealing with this. They have an institution dealing with the government part of it. But they don't have this sort of generic act with a regulator and implementing it for all the sectors. It's a more fractured thing. But we felt that in South Africa, it's going to be difficult enough to have one act enacted and get into place and so forth. It's going to be very difficult for us to have several acts, enact several acts for each different sector, and it's also going to be, it's going to create loopholes because, you know, you're going to create now a very good system for the health sector, and then there's not going to be enough for another sector or whatever. So if you have one act, you cover everything, and it's easier to do that.
The question is sometimes. Thank you, sir. I must congratulate you for the wide consultation, but I have a small question of clarity. In respect of the faculties of law at universities, how big was the sample of faculties that you consulted?
We send. We have different ways of which we consult with people. The major way of consulting is by sending out our documents for and asking for written submissions, and that of course is sent to every department, every faculty of law, and also the other faculties at departments. We have a very wide data list of people on the on our distribution list. We also send more than one copy to departments. So we would send it to different, if we think that it's, there will, may be different sections of the department that may be interested, we will send it to many people. So in that sense, we covered every single university and all the departments and many people within the departments. Insofar as the workshops are concerned, we extend invitations to all the universities, and we go to various areas in the country, and we extend invitations to all the universities, and there were quite a number of universities that attended it as well. I don't have the numbers. I can come back to you if you would like that specifically, but that was our whole workshop process. And then, of course, if there are people, if there are specific academics that are interested in a specific field, we will then deal with them specifically as well. And also on the project committee, we had, I think, three academics from KwaZulu-Natal and from WITS and from UNISA. There were people on our project committee as well.
Thanks, Chairperson. My first two questions are just process questions. You spoke about stages, issues, discussion, but something I missed at the beginning. Secondly, in your consultation, there's a group for whether it's an institution or a sector, which you said you had a lot of difficulties until you reached a consensus. I missed the name. The second issue, which is the main question, is in your international comparative studies, is there any mention of unique cultural sensitivities with regard to information management?
Okay, the first question, I think it was, we started off with the issue paper, and then we had the discussion paper, and then the report. Those were the three documents. And then the second question was the, what, I can't remember now.
You spoke about a group where you had long discussions.
Oh, yes, that was the Direct Marketing Association.
Okay.
Because it was about all the spam and the, you know, the marketing to people via telephone and so forth. And then the third, the cultural sensitivities. I don't really think so, because it's principle-based. You know, the idea of protecting the information. What is very important is there are some people that say, you've got no privacy, get used to it. You know, there are some people that say that in a world like today where you have the internet, you have Facebook and things like that, if a person puts himself on Facebook, then they have no privacy. But what we've found is in all the different cultures and also spread according to age, you know, from children and grown-ups and so forth, all people, they may put some of the information on it. But, you know, if you've got a lovely face, you may not mind if people put a photograph of your face on Facebook. But you may have very ugly legs, and then you wouldn't like your legs to be on Facebook. So the fact that you put your face on Facebook doesn't mean that you want your legs on Facebook. And that is really what our law also says. Something is private if you regard it as private and if you have indicated that you want your privacy protected. So for each person it's different. It's not the same for me as it is for you. Maybe for you it will be fine, and then that will not be protected. But if it's for me a big issue, then, you know, it will be protected. That's how our privacy in our law actually works.
Thank you, Chair President. Just one small question. You indicated that European Union countries are guided by human rights culture. And the OECD, I think, is guided by economic imperatives. What about the African countries that do have this legislation? What is their basis of this kind of legislation?
Honorable, I think the shifts have almost got closed, because the reason I wanted to ask this question, I'm just reminded about the recent development in South Africa, especially when we, the problems around the initiation and so on. I was just curious to check to what extent have you interfaced with the issues of that nation in actually legislating on information management.
Um, I think the countries in Africa that have the legislation are really, I would say, European-based in the sense, but remember, as I've explained before, the result of all this has been to get to 8 principles, and they are the same for everybody. So whether you come from the EU perspective or whether you come from the economic perspective doesn't mean that you have different rules. The result was the same. And I'm actually emphasizing the fact that people came from different areas only because of the fact that they came to the same result. And that is what makes it so unique in the sense that it's a balancing process that brought them exactly in the middle. When they got to these principles, it was already, the balancing act had already taken place. So it's not to say that people are now, at the moment, using different principles. The ones that come from the EU have one set of principles, and the ones coming from the economic perspective have another set of principles. The unique thing is that they have exactly the same principles. So if you ask, are they following the EU or the US example, actually all you're asking is, do they have one bill or do they have sector-specific pieces of legislation? And do they have one regulator or do they have a number of regulators dealing with it? So it's in the implementation that it still differs. But in the principle, it is exactly the same. And that is what makes this such a balanced piece of legislation, is because of the fact that they came from such different perspectives and they ended up exactly in the middle. So I wouldn't say that they have the one or the other, but I would say that they are following the EU example in the sense that they have a one generic act, and that's the same as we are having here. And to answer the question about cultural sensitivities and all these aspects, you know, this is why I was saying this is a very flexible act, because it's principle-based. You take these principles and you take something as diverse as the banking sector, and you take education, and you take rural areas, and you take the city environment. And these are just principles that you can apply anywhere. It is flexible enough that you can apply them anywhere. You can apply them in East Africa, you can apply them in Japan, or you can apply them in Indonesia or in Argentina. They have, in fact, been applied in all of those countries that I've just referred to. And although it is such different cultures and such different ideas, because it's principle-based and because it's generally accepted protection of information, it is possible to apply those 8 principles everywhere in the world.
I don't know if we're going to get international comparisons as we go through the bill, but it would just have been interesting on those points. I mean, the ones I'm particularly interested in is it's linked to the cultural issue. I think different countries rate different pieces, different categories of information differently, and it may relate to particular conditions at a particular time. So at the moment, for example, in South Africa, probably across the world, a person's economic dealings are things that are people are interested in, whereas a person's religion, people are not so much interested in. In America, one may be more interested in the religious persuasion of a person. So I know you talk about general principles, but would there be any recognition of different categories of information that a particular country may find more interesting than another, or would that be left up to the interpretation? And then the other issue would be the penalties. Is there much of a difference internationally in terms of the incorrect use of private information? Because it's all very well to say what may be done, but if you don't have penalties, then, you know, it's easy to break. So we did have the issue in this country with the issue of Dr. Shabalala Msimang's medical records and the publication of them in the newspaper. You know, it may be one thing to steal personal records, but it's another thing to actually then, or is it another thing to actually publicize them? And I don't think there were any, I don't think the newspaper was ever charged for that. I don't know if it is a crime in our country. Are there any changes being made on the whole issue of penalties, and what's the sort of international position on that?
That's a
I think you should answer that, but I want to now say to members who are leaping ahead. Now, what we need to do, we'll get the questions answered now, this one that has just come, and then we'll move to the next phase of the presentation. I think that's what we should do. Yeah.
I can just say, as far as the international position is concerned, in the report, as we dealt with each stage, we have referred to it quite comprehensively. So if you are interested in something specific, I think you will then find, especially in the footnotes, you will find the references to the other countries. We have followed we really took the OECD country, which is New Zealand, I asked around to people in the international field, and they informed me that New Zealand would be a very good country to take as an OECD country, because they had quite a comprehensive legislation. And then I checked it with the Netherlands, because they were a country being regarded as a good EU country. And what we have is really a case of cherry picking, which I've also been criticized for, but I think we try to get the best of practices in the world. So it is, we've taken quite a lot of examples in other countries and looked at the issues where we thought it was working the best in that particular country. So I can't tell you, that's where we started. We started with New Zealand and the Netherlands, but we've added, for instance, the penal sections comes from the UK, the whole system of notices and the whole idea of the information regulator being the same regulator for both the fire and the PIA. That's the recommendation at the moment. That comes from the UK, and there are also quite a number of things that comes from Canada. Specific issues that have been dealt with in Canadian legislation. So we have dealt with that. But I must say, insofar as personal information is concerned, there's really quite a lot of agreement on what personal information is. It's really all the person, anything that you can think of that's personal information is really included. And that's the same in all the countries. Although there are small differences, for instance, whether a juristic person should be included and so forth, there are, in the detail, there are some differences, but mostly people regard it as the same, and they make a distinction between ordinary personal information and specifically sensitive personal information. And then, insofar as the penalties are concerned, they differ very widely from one country to another. That is the one area where the EU directive is not very prescriptive. They are very prescriptive insofar as the principles are concerned. But the implementation, they've always said, must be done in accordance with the culture and the position of an individual country. So they are not very prescriptive insofar as penalties and enforcement is concerned. So there is quite a lot of leeway there. And I think the rest of it, I think Henk will deal with as we get on with the program.
Just for the international comparison and looking at the Law Commission report, it's a pity that the main focus has been on developed countries. I mean, it's the USA, Britain, Netherlands, New Zealand, Canada, Australia. And you've got a small section on other countries, paragraph basically, which you deal with Chile, Argentina, India, and the Philippines. And then you just have a one-line reference to the fact that certain other African countries have enacted the legislation. It's a pity that because when it comes to the monitoring and the state resources need, it's a pity that there was no developing country that was looked at. And we may need to get more information on similar developing countries.
If I could just answer that, I don't think you must look at the countries themselves so much. I think that was the final point in my presentation as well. Although we can look at the examples in other countries, they are just examples. The bill is based on the international instruments, and that is what we have to comply with if you want to adequacy rating. So that came from Europe, and it came from the OECD, which is an international organization, but it's not really driven by the developing countries. So I think we are a developing country in that sense that we have to comply with the EU directive and the OECD guidelines and also the UN guidelines and the Commonwealth. We are part of the Commonwealth, there's Commonwealth Model Law, which we've also referred to quite comprehensively in the report. So that is really where it comes from. The fact that we just use the examples of countries that have legislation already, it is not because we are following those countries, we are following the international instruments, and those are just examples. So I think it's important to know that we are not following really the examples in other countries, we are following the international instruments. And then the countries in Africa that I've mentioned, you know, they have only, I think Senegal was the first one, that was in 2006. And the other three only got their legislation this year, two of them this year and one at the end of last year. So it was really after the report has been written. So I was just adding it now because I've now become, you know, I've now noted the fact that they actually have the legislation. And they are also following the EU example. So it's really the instruments that are important, not the other countries.
Yeah, but I think it's correct in thinking they're all French-speaking countries, aren't they? So they come directly via France, directly via the EU directive.
Mr. Chair, may I just ask for 5 minutes? I would just like to concur with my colleague. I would like to maybe request her to mention something to us during the concluding part of a part of the presentation. But I would just like to maybe, with your permission, just take a 5 minute break, please, so that we can just quickly have a discussion. Yes.
Question, why did you choose CPI in South Africa? And that is just a sort of a conclusion. I think we've already seen, first of all, that Parliament requested the legislation, so we are already trying to address that request. Secondly, we've looked at the protection, the information protection worldwide, and we see that it's necessary for South Africa to get adequate rating in order for our trade to be unencumbered. I think what is important to note, just as I haven't mentioned yet, is all the key users of the personal information, just to give you examples, and they are telephone companies, retailers, credit bureaus, the health and medical profession, banks, financial institutions, the insurance industry, the direct marketing industry, and then, of course, all the public bodies, such as all the government departments and agencies, educational institutions, local authorities, and the police. So it's very wide-ranging. The other thing that I would just like to emphasize is that privacy has become an important trade issue, as information privacy concerns can create a barrier to international trade. And we've looked at the global economic position, which the rating will definitely ensure free flow of information, both nationally and internationally. But what I just want to emphasize in this regard is the fact that this will stimulate the economy and provide employment opportunities. For instance, in the call center industry, the business process outsourcing industry, South Africa is very well positioned in the sense that our trading language is English, which is the same as many other countries, and we are also in the same time zone as Europe, which also is an advantage in the call center industry specifically. And, of course, proper protection will furthermore ensure consumer confidence and trust in electronic online business activities. If you're not sure what the entity is going to do with your credit card information, you may not be so willing to provide that information. If you want to be part of the whole new internet business scene, you must ensure that you protect information properly. So this is really, insofar as the international position is concerned, as also the consumer position is concerned. But then the third thing that I think I haven't touched on yet, and that is, what does this mean for the individual, for the man in the street, and what is the relevance of all this, the protection of personal information, insofar as the protection is a basic human right. Now, I think it's clear that information privacy touches almost every aspect of our daily lives. I think if you all just sit for a minute and think of how many instances you have actually provided your personal information, how many files are being held of you. I think that somebody counted them as something like 67 files, something for an ordinary person. If you think where you've provided your information on the internet, to your doctor, at the school, at the church, you know, at your employment, wherever they are, there are really a number of files being held of every person, and that information is being used every day to make decisions about you. So the question is whether you are going to get the job that you've applied for or the house that you've applied for will quite often depend on the information that's being kept of a person. So it can be, the consequences can be serious if that information is irrelevant or used for purposes that are incompatible with or contrary to the purpose for which it was collected. It's confused with someone else's information. It's been entered wrongly. It's out of date, etc. It will definitely have an impact on the dignity, integrity, and independence of a person if your information is being used incorrectly. And as I said, the consequences can be serious. Undetected information may furthermore lead to identity theft and other criminal offences. We all know how many cases of identity theft I've personally been the victim of an identity theft where my information, my handbag was stolen and my information was used to open up accounts and so forth in my name. That is a real problem today, so security is very important. The security of information is very important, and as I said, we would like to give the same protection that we used to give 50 years ago. There's also the proliferation of unsolicited pornography, spam, and direct marketing excesses. At the moment, there are no rules regulating direct marketing, and it's a free-for-all, and I think it's a good idea to have that regulated as well. Children and other vulnerable parties are also currently unprotected, especially insofar as the internet and other electronic devices are concerned. We have looked at children as well in this legislation, specifically to protect their rights. And finally, I think the privacy legislation will also provide a safe environment within which the current e-government initiative can be developed. I think government is engaging in a very exciting project where information will be available, especially insofar as hospitals are concerned, also insofar as courts are concerned. There's the whole e-government, e-justice, e-health projects that are taking place. But especially we would appreciate all of that because it's going to assist immeasurably in dealing with all kinds of problems in government. But at the same time, we need a proper framework to protect the information that we are engaging in, you know, the information that's being collected. So that's more or less it. I think it is, it's just important to note that South Africa is actually peculiar in the sense that we also protect, in terms of our constitution, we also protect a juristic person. I would just like to say something about that. I just mentioned it a little bit earlier. It's not usually the case because the whole sort of impetus of this information protection really comes from Europe and it's human rights based. They do not regard the juristic person as an individual that needs protection from a human rights perspective. So most countries in Europe do not protect juristic persons. There are exceptions, for instance, Switzerland and Italy. But in South Africa, we have the position that the interpretation of the Constitutional Court of the common law principles in two cases, the Financial Mail case as well as the Janet case, they indicated that it can be the violation of the privacy of a juristic person, even if you cannot speak in the case of such a person of feelings being outraged or offended. So the basis for this protection is the privacy like reputation can be infringed without injured feelings. And that was confirmed in Janet, and it was also referred to in the Hyundai case. Where it was held that juristic persons enjoy the right to privacy but is not protected to the same extent as natural persons since juristic persons are not the bearers of human dignity. And the level of justification for any particular limitation of the right would have to be judged in light of the circumstances of each case. So that has been included in this legislation where we've said that the protection of personal information will also be where applicable. It will be protected where applicable. And I just wanted to give you that information so that you can see that it is different. It's not a prescript of the EU directive, so whether it's included or not will not change the whole adequacy rating position of South Africa. However, that's the law of the country, so it is true that there are instances, for instance, the credit information of a company may be interesting or may be worthwhile protecting. And therefore we have included that in our legislation. There are other countries as well. I've mentioned Italy and Switzerland in Europe. There's also Mexico in South America. They also included it. and Argentina as well. So there are countries that included it. I think it depends on the position, the legal position in the country itself. That's just something that you may want to think about. So I'm finished, and I'm quite happy to hand over to Hink for a discussion of the bill itself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Possibly just to start off by indicating that the bill itself and the various chapters of the bill are actually aimed at achieving three main objectives. First of all, important enough, the chapters 2, 3, and 4 will be primarily devoted into introducing the information protection principles. Chapters 5 to 9 will deal with the supervision, and then the remaining chapters primarily deal with enforcement. I would like to immediately indicate to you, Mr. Chair, and maybe attach to the whole briefing by Ms. Lowe, is possibly to indicate at this stage that since we do have a draft framework piece of legislation, the role of the regulator that is envisaged in terms of this act will be extremely important in the success of the implementation and enforcement of the piece of legislation that we have before us here today. Just to start off, before we get to the bill itself, to give you a general overview of the bill. The bill primarily aims to promote the protection of personal information processed by public and private bodies. It aims to introduce the information protection principles. We have already discussed that quite extensively this morning. It also provides for the establishment then of the information protection regulator. Also equally important, there's provision made for codes of conduct to be issued in terms of the bill. And then the rights of persons regarding unsolicited electronic communications and automated decision-making will be regulated in terms of the bill, and then also the flow of personal information across the borders of the Republic. If the members have the bill in front of them, I would really now, with your permission, Mr. Chair, get to the quite boring part of the briefing to take you through the bill itself. The bill is divided into 12 chapters. I'm on page 3 at the moment, Mr. Chair, and various of the chapters are also divided into different parts. On page 3 and further, we have our index to the bill itself. I'm not going to bore you with the details there. I would like to take you to clause 1 of the bill. Generally, Mr. Chair, we do not spend very much time on the definitions clause at this stage because as the briefing on the provisions of the bill proceeds, we will come back to some of the more important definitions, but I would like to highlight possibly 4 or 5 of them at this stage, just possibly to assist in a better understanding of what will follow and the terms that we use. Most of the definitions contained in Clause 1 are generally self-explanatory, but I think one would like to at this stage possibly refer you to the definition of personal information on page 7 of the bill. First of all, it's important to note that it's not a closed list. So what we have in paragraphs A to H just adds to what we see at this stage our definition should be. You will also note that if we look at the definition, the reference to not only natural persons, but juristic persons is there as well. Personal information, in short, will be information relating to a person's race, gender, sex, pregnancy, marital status, national, ethnic, or social origin, color, sexual orientation, age, physical or mental health, well-being, disability, religion, conscience, belief, culture, language, birth, and birth of the person, and then also information relating to the education or the medical, financial, criminal, or employment history of a person, Then we also include identifying numbers, symbols, also our email addresses, physical addresses, telephone numbers, etc. And then biometric information of a person, including your blood type, and then personal opinions, views, and preferences of a person is also regarded as personal information. And then, of course, correspondence sent by a person under certain circumstances, and then the views or opinions of another individual about a person. And then finally, the name of the person, if it appears with other personal information relating to that person, or if the disclosure of the name of the person itself would reveal information about the person. So that is the first important definition that we will be finding reference to throughout the course of our briefing. The other important definition is also the definition of processing, which is also on page 8. Processing is a very wide definition, and it includes all those aspects which relate to the handling of personal information. For example, the collection, receipt, recording, collation, storage, retrieval, alteration, the dissemination of personal information by means of distribution or making it available in any other form, or then the merging or the linking, as well as the blocking and degradation or the destruction of that information. The term record is also important for purposes of the other provisions of our bill. And in short, maybe just to indicate, Mr. Chair, that it is also a very wide definition, understandably so. The term record will mean any recorded information regardless of form or medium, and then including any writing on any materials, information produced, recorded, or stored by any mechanical device, especially with thinking of computer hardware and software, etc. And then also a label, marking, or other writing that identifies or describes anything of which it forms part, a book, map, plan, graph, or a drawing, and then also photographs, films, tapes, etc., which is in the possession and under control of the responsible party, whether it was created by the responsible party or not, and then also regardless of when it came into existence. You will find, Mr. Chair, that the very similar definition is contained in the Promotion of Access to Information Act, especially where we refer to regardless of when the record came into existence. The next term which we need to have a quick look at, we already find in the definition of record, and that is what is a responsible party. And a responsible party is nothing else. The definition appears on page 9, nothing else than a public or private body or any other person which alone or in conjunction with others determines the purpose of and the means for processing of personal information. The final definition that I would like to just quickly direct your attention to, we find in the beginning of clause 1, and that is the definition of data subject. We've just had a look at responsible party, and that's one of the two main players in this bill. The data subject, of course, is the other main player, and actually the nothing else than the person to whom the personal information relates. So if we refer during the course of this little briefing to responsible parties, it will be those people or institutions who process personal information, and if we refer to the data subject, it will then be primarily the individual, him or herself. Clause 2 of the bill, on page 9, provides for the purpose of the bill, which in short amounts to the bill aiming to protect the right to privacy with regard to the processing of personal information, balancing the right to privacy against other rights, such as the right of access to information, and protecting important interests, including the free flow of information within or across the borders of our country, and then also to regulate the manner in which personal information may be processed by, among others, establishing those 8 information principles in harmony with international standards that prescribe the minimum threshold requirements for the lawful processing of personal information. Maybe I could just quickly refer to subclause 2 of the clause itself. Subclause 2 aims to address the general concern that the promotion of the bill will in certain cases prohibit the processing of personal information by responsible parties. That is not the case, and that is why we have subclause 2 there. The clause therefore aims to clarify that the proposed legislation must be interpreted in a manner that, among others, does not prevent any responsible party from exercising or performing its powers, duties, and functions in terms of the law, as far as those functions, powers, and duties relate to the processing of personal information, but with the important proviso that it is in accordance with this proposed legislation or then any other legislation that regulates the processing of personal information. Chapter 2, Clause 3, page 9, deals with the application of the Act and provides that the Act will apply to the processing of personal information entered into a record by or for a responsible party domiciled in the Republic or which is not domiciled in the Republic but uses automated or non-automated means that are situated in the Republic, except if those automated means are merely to forward personal information. The wide ambit of Clause 3, Mr. Chair, among others, necessitates certain exclusions, which in certain instances are qualified. Some of our exclusions are qualified. We will see them in Clause 4. Maybe just to indicate that some of the exclusions are not qualified and 2 or 3 of them are qualified. So Clause 4 in essence provides that the bill will not apply to the processing of personal information in certain circumstances. For example, in paragraph A, in the course of purely personal or household activity, I think that is the most obvious and logic exclusion that should be created, is that we do not want to impose this information or protection regime on a person who merely has a little black book of his or her friends and family members, etc. In paragraph B, we will find that the Act will also not apply to the processing of personal information where that personal information has been de-identified to the extent that it cannot be re-identified again. The term de-identified is also defined in Clause 1 of our bill, and it merely means that as soon as you transform your information to the extent where you cannot really add the detail of a person to the information itself, then you do not have a problem as far as the protection of personal information is concerned. The term de-identify in relation to personal information of a data subject is defined as the deletion of any information that identifies the data subject, can be used or manipulated by a reasonably foreseeable method to identify the data subject, or can be linked by a reasonably foreseeable method to other information that identifies the data subject. The
I will request your indulgence. Both paragraph A and paragraph B. I think I need better ways of clarification. I'm sorry to drag the process. Something I understand.
Tell us, what is your problem?
My problem is simply that question. I don't understand. Because you talk about personal information, this other side is explained what it is. Now here you're saying purely personal or household activity. If I could clarify the minimum distinction between that and with having articulated in the definition.
Examples.
Even if it's examples.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it's important that we take our time with these clauses because it's technically a very difficult pill just to understand off the cuff. Yes, maybe we could take one step backwards and say that personal information is all the type of information that relates to myself as an individual, as we indicated in our definitions clause. It's my identity number, my blood type, etc., etc. But the exclusions are important. If you look at the application provision of our Act, it indicates to us that the Act applies to the processing of personal information. That, in essence, is what the Act applies to. So, in other words, if I process personal information, we have that definition of processing. If I collect certain personal information from someone else, and it's my business to process that information, or I process personal information for economic purposes, then I will be subject to the provisions of the Act itself and the information protection principles. But we must keep in mind that I, in my private capacity as an individual, might, for example, process information, strictly speaking, process personal information in terms of the bill, but it is for personal purposes. In other words, I, for example, get the information of my friends, where they live, what their full names are, what their dates of birth are, etc. I don't process that information for economic purposes. I process that information in my private capacity. That is why we need to exclude that type of processing of personal information of other people from the provisions of the bill itself. I do not know whether, and I'm with your indulgence as well, Mr. Chair, I will always turn to Ananda just to get an indication whether she would also like to add something. At this stage, I'm really not giving myself out as the expert of the subject matter itself. Is something
I've just given an example. If you want to all the parties and you put down all your friends' names and their telephone numbers and you're going to use that to phone them, that's processing of information because it's their personal information and you are actually using that information, but you're using it to have a party. Now, that will not be included in the Act. It won't be included in the Act. The Act will not be applicable to it. You can protect it, but it's your own. It's just informal use of the information, and there's this relationship between you and your friends, and it's your personal use. You're not going to publish it or send it to somebody else or do something with it. So it's just for your personal use that you are collecting the information.
If I'm containing that information, I'm possessing that information, that kind of information, in terms of the law, it is not governed by this law.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, because I think often there's quite a lot of public interest in parties and who attends. So I have a party, I compile the list, I leave it lying around, or it gets stolen from me. It's in my briefcase, and it gets stolen and then used. Would it ever fall under the Act?
Yes, it will, because then it's a different responsible party. You see, you using it for your purposes, you collect it for a specific purpose, you use it only for the purpose that you collected it for, which is an informal purpose. But if somebody steals it, say for instance the journalist or whatever, and now he's out of that domain. He's not using it for his personal, he's using it for
just a small question. Where do tracing agents think again? Those people follow people and you know, take the information and not take it.
Mr. Chair, they will also be subject to the provisions of the proposed legislation. But we will get to portions of the bill where those examples will immediately come to mind. And especially the example just given of a list lying around and it being stolen, one of our information protection principles addresses that directly. Mr. Chair, thank you. Then another exclusion is where the processing of personal information takes place by or on behalf of the state. But we would like to immediately indicate that this is one of the
probably just not to begin. I will need personal. I just want to be honest. I'm trying to struggle to understand what is being explained. And I must honestly say, maybe during tea time or any other time, I'll honestly say I still want to understand this distinction.
And we might have to organize the workshop for the member. It seems to me like it's not as complicated as we make it out to be. My simple understanding is that if you have information which you use for personal use, personal meaning you who's got the information, and you don't pass it on to the other people for other purposes, that is excluded by the Act. Any other thing then falls under the ambit of the Act. Simply put, that's what I said. Yeah, let's proceed. Yeah, we can still discuss it at some point, but I think let's go.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Paragraph C, so the processing of personal information by or on behalf of the state is also excluded from the Act when it involves national security, defense, public safety, or where it takes place for the purpose of the prevention, investigation, or proof of offenses, the prosecution of offenders, or the execution of sentences or security measures. However, to the extent that adequate safeguards have been established in specific legislation for the protection of such personal information. The second or the fourth exclusion, which is also subject to a proviso to a certain extent, is where the processing of personal information takes place for exclusively journalistic purposes by responsible parties who are subject to, or by virtue of office, employment, profession, subject to a code of ethics that provides adequate safeguards for the protection of personal information.
I mean, two issues. One is what the state should not have been defined. Why isn't there a definition of state? And then obviously coming on to D, does this then mean that journalists are excluded? Because they presumably would fall under the Press Council and they would have a code of ethics under the Press Council. So are you saying that journalists, I don't know if you have to be a registered journalist or how it works, but that they're excluded.
Thank you. On the same two subsections, I didn't want to stop us at C, but please just think on C. This Act now doesn't apply where the prevention, investigation, or proof of offences is at issue. To the extent that adequate safeguards have been established in specific legislation for the protection of such personal information. Now, we know that there is a law coming dealing with the use of the entire fingerprint database in this country, even those of Home Affairs, which, as I understand it, but I'm not very well informed on this, has not until now been accessible to the police. I mean, the police fingerprint database is surely that of criminals, and as I understand it, every database is now to be thrown open to the police. Now, what you're saying is that this Act will not try to protect my privacy, provided that that new fingerprint, forensic, whatever it's called, bill, has sufficient safeguards established. But, you know, if in my view that bill precisely doesn't give sufficient safeguards, do we now lose any protection here? And I just want to ask a further question. Sooner or later, you must address us, please, on the Caster Semenya case and genetic privacy, or call it what you like. In the definitions, personal information is already described as including sex, race, gender, sex, and there was reference to, under sub D, to the blood type and any other biometric information of the person, but you have not specifically referred to genetics. Is there a case for doing that? You have a definition dealing with de-identification, which presumably deals with genetic material or other medical material that cannot be traced to the person concerned. We just need your broad input on this, please. And how does that play under exclusions for sub C? Then a question on the journalists. Now, there's no statute that says journalists have to have the press ombudsman. It's a kind of self-regulation, which is what you want under free speech. So if journalists do not, in fact, belong to the, whatever they call it these days, they call it NASA or something, they have a new name. If a publication doesn't belong to the NASA, and that or that newspaper or magazine doesn't submit to the ombudsman, where does that leave them?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. John Jeffrey, he hit the nail right on the head. Possibly before I started, I should have actually indicated that when we went through our bill, we already picked up a few technical issues. So with regard to the definition of state, we would most probably, after consulting with our state law advisor who certified the bill as well, would most probably want to replace the term state with public body. But that is, so possibly if you would accept it at this stage. Maybe, Mr. Chair, I should, where possible, and I really don't want to bore the committee at this stage with technical detail, but there are quite a number of technical issues that we've already picked up that we would like to come back to the committee and request them from our side as amendments already, but it does not impact on the content or the substance of the bill itself, but that is one example. The whole question around the journalists, I think I might be able to answer that, and I'm most probably going to ask Ms. Ananda Lai to add as well. We must realize one thing, that although it is painted as an exclusion in terms of the Act, it's an important exclusion to the extent that you will only be excluded from the provisions of this Act as a journalist if you are subject to, for example, then a code of ethics that provides adequate safeguards for the protection of personal information. Strictly speaking, what that will amount to in practice is if a dispute arises between an individual and a member of the journalistic society, that person will, of course, be free to approach the information protection regulator and argue that they are not subject to a code, even if the response is, but I am subject to a code, if there's no adequate information protection principles or regulatory framework within that code, then you will, and I'm speaking on the correction, fall back under the application of the Act. because it is a provider, because it is a provider.
Maybe, Chair, maybe they could ask, add, why do you want this exclusion?
That's an underlined too.
Yes, you know, it was actually funny in the end, because as going from one sector to the other, everybody wants to be excluded. That's the first thing they ask, to be excluded, and then they give lots of reasons why they can be excluded. So I always say it's not necessary to be excluded from this act, because we are dealing with basic minimum requirements, which is good business practice. So it's good for you to be included in the act. It's good for everybody to be included, because it gives you the framework within which to work. That having said that, In our original draft, in the discussion paper bill, we did not include an exclusion for journalistic purposes. The reason being that it's so difficult these days to determine who's actually a journalist, because anybody can publish on the internet. I mean, you can publish very widely on the internet without being part of really being a journalist in the sense that we used to know it. So we didn't include it, but we received quite a number of good submissions. Explaining why it will make it difficult for ordinary newspaper men to do their work, their daily work, if they have to comply with all the different principles in detail. And what we came up with was really this exclusion, only a limited exclusion, in the sense that the code of ethics, if you are then not a member of the journalistic fraternity who are subject to a code of ethics, you will be subject to this bill. However, it doesn't really make that much a difference. The exclusion doesn't make that much a difference, because it only gives the journalists some form of self-regulation or co-regulation almost, if you want to call it that, because they are able to deal with it themselves. They can set up their own code of ethics, or in their code of ethics, and we have discussed it also in the report and referred to the codes that exist at the moment. They are not, there are no problems with the codes, but they are not sufficiently, they haven't included the principles to a sufficient extent. So they will have to look at their codes and broaden their codes to actually make provision for the principles themselves. So it is actually providing them with the opportunity up front of dealing with it in their own way. But if they don't, then they will be subject to the act. It's just giving them a little bit of freedom to deal with it. It's also in accordance with the rest of the bill of codes of conduct, where, for instance, the banking association can develop a code of conduct, and if that is approved by the regulator, then they can have an adjudicator in terms of that code, and they can also deal with it. But they always stay under the control of the regulator in the end. And this is the same for the journalists as well. But it gives them a little bit of freedom to deal with their own issues in their own way. That's really all that happens. But they must always take cognizance of the principles in the Act, and they must deal with it. I think an important thing that I must state upfront is that there's a difference between exclusions, exemptions, and exceptions. Now, the exclusion will be what we're dealing with now in Section 4. If you are excluded from the Act, if you are completely excluded without the reservation, then you can throw the bill in the waste box and never have to look at it again. That's an exclusion. Exemption is when you can, in terms of Section 34 of the Act, you can request an exemption of a specific principle. If it makes it impossible for you to do your work or to do whatever you have to process the information, if you do not have that exemption from that specific principle, you can request that from the regulator, and then you can you do not have to comply with that. But what is important are really the exceptions. In each principle, you will find exceptions. Each time, the principle will be stated. You have to collect the information directly from the data subject. But then the exceptions are there. In the following instances, it's not necessary to comply with that principle. And those are the exceptions. It's really qualifications of the principle, and it should be read. It really tells you what the principle is about. How does this principle work? And I think that those if you are a responsible party, first of all, you will try to find yourself within the principle and see if you are complying with the principle itself. Then you can have a look and see whether you shouldn't get an exemption. And only if it's impossible to deal with it in that way, then exclusions will come into play. And that is really the position with regards to journalists have now been included. As I say, they weren't included at first, in the sense that they will be able to deal with their position themselves, insofar as it is possible in terms of this subsection D. We do not see that is a big difference from the code of conduct, and in that sense, I think the question as to whether it's really necessary may perhaps be asked. However, we do feel it's a little bit, it gives them a little bit more freedom, and it gives a little bit more credence to the whole idea freedom of the press in terms of the constitution. But it's not a very big change, as you know, with regards to the position, if they may have, in terms of the act, dealt with it in terms of a code of conduct for the journalistic field. Not a big change. They have it now already, whereas if otherwise they would have to go through the whole process and apply for it.
Yeah. Probably, I want to thank you for your explanation. Actually, what I'm at conflict with is that, for instance, if I go back there, I think I understood now about the explanation of the paper. I think what I'm at conflict with is that if you're not going to use it for other purposes, how do you safeguard that? Could be too much of a detailed question. If one says I collect information for personal what to call purpose, how do you safeguard that information is not going to be used for? To me, it could be the underlying concern from what JJ is asking around the journalist. If you exclude the journalist and so on, what guarantees the minimum safe that other information are being protected, okay? If that sort of explanation can actually be brought to bear in one way or another. This is exactly what I'm actually...
Can I just add to that? Honorable Smuts raised the issue of Castasomania. Personal information is leaked, allegedly leaked, okay? There's been no official report that has been produced. Personal information is allegedly leaked. That information is then covered in all the media so that the whole world knows what it is. So it was probably improperly obtained. If it is accurate, it was improperly obtained evidence or information. Now, what is the position now? Will there be any change afterwards, after this bill is enacted, as far as journalists are concerned?
Yeah, maybe what you should be saying about the journalists is the assumption is that they are a responsible lot capable of regulating themselves, their industry, their enterprise, which is not always accurate. And then what we need to do with this bill, if it is not provided for, is that when they fail to self-regulate, the bill kicks in. I think that's my understanding. Is that it? That's my understanding, that they're excluded to the extent that they show responsibility, they self-regulate. And when they fail to self-regulate, they lose the protection. In other words, the exclusion is removed. They lose it by their own behavior. The act kicks in.
My correct answer to say even in 4 paragraph A, that would apply.
No, Mr. Chair, it won't apply here.
No, no. You know why I'm saying this? If I... If I understood the explanation of that, if I collect this for personal purpose and I'm not going to use, then I'm excluded. But I'm saying, if in the course of life, it can be actually discovered that it went beyond. And that's the point I'm trying to make, that it went beyond what the chairperson is saying. Since if journalists do not conduct themselves responsibly, then they lose that protocol, that protection. The reason I'm coming to paragraph A is that I don't think we're presupposing that individuals, when they do this thing, they are not tempted to use abuses.
Mr. Chair, that will be and answering the last question first. That will most probably be the bottom line will be a factual question. Whether you are using it for purely household and personal purposes or not. If, for example, you are reckless in the use of or the processing of personal information where you claim an exclusion in terms of the Act. For example, you present the exclusion that is for purely personal or household activities. Then it does not mean that the person is offended through the processing of that information, you giving it out, etc., etc. Does not mean that that person is without the remedy in terms of our law.
The person comes back. But I think I'm clarified because I was worried about a presupposition that it is for if you have claimed that it's for personal purposes, then there's this automatic holiness and honesty of the highest order. Thank you.
Can somebody just explain the Casus Amenia issue of
on a good mind.
Mr. Chair, may I just interrupt? Before we skipped a few questions, if we could just quickly go back to them before we receive follow-ups, because I'm just becoming extremely confused. And I'm becoming confused now. Who's my chair?
In my absence, he tends to act. But I'm back here.
Thank you, Chair. The short technical answer with regard to definitions, especially the definition of personal information, would be that we do not have a numerous classes. It's not a closed list. The example during discussions recently between the three of us, a simple example like one's IQ, would one argue that is personal information? Certainly it's personal information. It's so personal that you don't even know. Remember those days when IQ tests were done, etc., etc. So that's just one example of what we can add to the definition of personal information. Now, to go over to the example that was given, and I think similar approach or principle will apply with regard to the answer that we've just given to household activities and personal information. Currently, and I suppose there's a wide range of legal obligations that are applicable in the example that was given and information allegedly being leaked out, etc., which I can certainly not see a person who is offended through that process will not be without any remedy. We are looking at possibly privacy issues in any event. You will recall when we had our briefing on the whole privacy issue and dignity, etc., that the law in that regard is covered by the common law as well to a great extent the constitutional law, the So that is the current position. The position after the bill will become enforced, I think the bottom line is, first of all, one will have to determine whether it was a public or a private body that processed the personal information. That, to a certain extent, with the view to your remedies, does not really make a difference. It's the remedies that are really important, and then, of course, the enforcement mechanism where one has the additional protection that if your personal information was incorrectly processed in terms of our framework, then you do have the remedies, you do have the assistance of the information protection regulator, and eventually you can even bring a civil claim to a certain extent. So that is what the position will be post protection of personal information. In order for a claim to be successful, one will have to be able to indicate whether there was a breach of one of our information protection principles, and that is also a factual question. Mr. Chair, sorry, I think Ms. Lowe would also like to add here.
I think one must also realize that there is a distinction being made between ordinary personal information and then processing of special personal information, which is in Part B on page 16 of the bill. And it actually says in 25, unless specifically permitted by this part, the responsible party may not process personal information concerning a child, etc., and then B, the other subject, religious or philosophical beliefs, race or ethnic origin, trade union membership, political opinions, health, sexual life, or criminal behavior. So it is prohibited in 25. Then again, in the whole sort of balancing act that we're always doing, there are exemptions, and the specific exemption that I think that will apply to Kenya will be 30, exemption concerning a data subject's health or sexual life, where they say that if it's your health, sexual life, if it's a medical professional, the healthcare institution or so forth, insurance companies, etc., schools and so forth, dealing with it, it's in order. But, I mean, it doesn't make provision for the press to deal with the personal information. But I think we must perhaps just wait until we get to that section and we can deal with that then in more depth when we look at the special processing of special personal information, because I think it falls under that section of the bill. And apart from that, I agree with Inc that I think in so far as a person whose information has been infringed, the rights have been infringed, it will be the civil claim that will perhaps assist that person most. But I think we will get there.
Right early on, that this is not a consent-driven bill. But that issue will surely have to come in when we deal with your Section 30 and elsewhere.
The bill is not a consent-driven bill. There are two exceptions. The one is special personal information, and the other is unsolicited electronic communication. So there are two specific exceptions to that.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. The box of receiving these questions, we can now proceed from clauses 33 onwards. Mr. Chair, yes, and then just to quickly finish off with clause 4 is the exclusion clause, then of course is paragraph E. Relates to cabinet and its committees, the executive council of a province and the municipal council of a municipality. They will be also be excluded from the provisions of the bill. And then also the processing of personal information relating to the judicial functions of the court, referred in 166 of our constitution. And then finally the processing of personal information that has been exempted from the application of the information protection principles in terms of Section 34. Clause 34 provides for, or the regulator, the information protection regulator, to receive applications for exemptions, consider them, and then grant exemptions from certain information protection principles to be complied with. We will get there, but in short, it amounts to, in practice, once again, it may sometimes be difficult for a responsible party and possibly even unjustifiable unjustly for a responsible party to comply with a specific information protection principle. And I suppose it's merely a question of fairness to provide the regulator with the power to grant certain exemptions. We are not saying through this legislation that thousands and thousands of exemptions will be granted, but since we do work with framework legislation to a certain extent, one should envisage that the need for specific sectors to be exempted from certain principles will exist, and if they will be considered by the information protection regulator. Clause 5 deals with the saving, and it merely provides...
Just on that, the legislatures are not excluded, are not exempted. I can see the directives. You see there is cabinet, and there's also executive council of provinces, and there's also municipal council of municipalities. So the legislatures.
On that point, I mean, looking at those bodies, cabinet and executive council are not open to the public, and their documents are classified. Whereas a municipal council, I mean, it's not even an expo, is a legislature, not an executive. And even if it were the expo meetings are open to the public. So I don't know if that issue was looked at. I'm not sure if
there is wanting to widen it to legislatures, but maybe you could just give a little more detail around those aspects as well. What is sort of more meant by relating to the judicial functions of a court?
I think the reason why it was included is it's the same as FIRE. We've tried to harmonize the two pieces of legislation to the extent that it's possible, and those are the exclusions that you find in FIRE. However, I will have to come back to you, but I have a feeling that in E, the Municipal Council of the Municipality was inserted later during one of the processes, and I think it was because the argument was that the Municipal Council is the same to the municipality as the Cabinet is to, you know, the Executive Council is to the province and so forth. But if that is not the case, then I think it can be removed again. I think it was just added because people said, well, what about the municipality then? And it was included at some stage during the processing of the bill. But I will have to look it up and see exactly what it is. But I know that these exemptions, the exclusions, you know, the ones that are specifically pertaining to this legislation is the first ones, but the last few came from FIRE because we tried to harmonize it as far as possible.
But it may not.
Yes, I don't think it's a good reason for them, but that's the answer.
My assumption, although you are committing yourself to correct, my assumption is that if you were to exclude what you call municipality and refer to a structure that is relevant at that level, it could be what you call it, mayoral committee, probably the concern would not apply. The point I'm trying to make is that I understand the difference between the legislature and the executive, why they would be treated differently. But if you stop municipality now, then you have to explain why legislature not involved.
I think it's a wording problem. Yeah, on this one. Anyway, I think let's move forward a bit. In other words, when we try and refinalize it after they come back, it's a question of rewording it. Naming it what it is, or leaving it out if we think the protections are not. That we are still going to discuss, to debate. Yeah. Still going to debate whether we did it in or out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clause 5 provides that the Act does not affect the operation of any other legislation that regulates the processing of personal information and is capable of operating concurrently with the Act. And then if there's any other legislation that provides the safeguards for the protection of personal information that are more extensive than those set out in the information protection principles, the more extensive safeguards will prevail. And then clause 6 is...
Regarding clause 5, what happens in the case where that other legislation is not capable of operating concurrently with this Act?
If the subject matter is purely the protection of personal information, then this Act trumps any other legislation that does not provide. I think that is the
principle. Not necessary.
Mr. Chair, I think that is certainly something that we should have a look at, because our clause does not expressly state that at this stage. So that is certainly something that we will note. And report back and have a look at it. Mr. Chair, yes, thank you. Clause 6 actually states the obvious, and that's that the Act applies or binds public and private bodies. Strictly speaking, in a technical sense, it's really not necessary to have a clause like this. But we've decided to include it
for what purpose? That it is stated.
Mr. Chair, yes. The mere fact that we have definitions of public and private bodies means that the bottom line is that the Act applies across all borders of society. But I suppose it's a question of belts and braces. We sometimes like it. Yes, Chair. Chapter 3 consists of two parts, and this is sort of the central point of this piece of legislation, is the information protection principles being introduced in terms of Chapter 3, Part A, and then also Part B, and I could just briefly refer to that on page 16. Part B aims to regulate the processing of personal information. You will recall that during the few previous questions, Ms. Lowe highlighted that we must just keep in mind that if we use some of these examples, they will, among others, specifically apply to Part B, the whole prohibition in respect of the processing of special personal information. But we can start on page 10 by referring you to the first principle, the principle of accountability, that is clause 7, and it requires that the responsible party must ensure that the principles, our 8 principles, and all the measures that give effect to the principles are complied with. So in short, that is the accountability principle as reflected in clause 7. Principle 2 relates to processing limitation, and there are 4 clauses that are applicable there. You will recall the example that Mr. Jeffrey used of the household activity, my little black book list. it being stolen and then used or misused. This is one of the principles that immediately came to mind when he used that example. The processing limitation deals, among others, with the lawfulness of processing in terms of Clause 8, which provides that personal information must be processed lawfully and in a reasonable manner that does not infringe the privacy of a data subject. Together with that, we've got the aspect of minimality with regard to the processing limitation principle, which provides that personal information may only be processed if given the purpose for which it is processed. It is adequate, relevant, and not excessive. Then we reach an interesting one in Clause 10, and which deals with consent, justification, and objection. Clause 10 provides that personal information may only be processed if the data subject consents to the processing, but that is one of a number of options. So one of the options is I consent to the processing of my personal information, and this is where we tend to start answering the question of consent-driven. What we're actually trying to say is that the bill is not consent-driven, but it's one of the aspects which will enable compliance with this principle, is if I have the consent of a data subject to process personal information, but it's not the only one. The others are reflected in B to F. For example, in paragraph B, processing is necessary to carry out actions for the conclusion or the performance of a contract to which the data subject is a party. Processing complies with an obligation imposed by law on the responsible party. Processing protects the legitimate interests of a data subject, or where processing is necessary for the proper performance of a duty by a public body. And then finally, processing is necessary for pursuing legitimate interests of responsible parties or of a third party to whom the information is supplied. Subclause 2 provides that a data subject may object at any time on reasonable grounds relating to his or her particular situation in the prescribed manner to the processing of personal information in terms of paragraphs D to F, unless otherwise provided for in national legislation. And then paragraph 3, subclause 3 provides that if a data subject has objected to the processing of personal information, the responsible party may no longer process that information. And then,
but I mean, that presupposes then that the data subject must be informed on DTF.
Yes, it to a certain extent it does, and one of our principles is, and we'll get to that principle that a person must be informed if his personal information is processed. And if I could remember correctly, yes, we'll get to that principle, Mr. Chair, and I think we could possibly let it stand down until then, and then we can adapt.
That's a bit back to the other section where we're talking about in the event of a conflict. Because here, now, F, it says, unless otherwise provided for in national legislation. But it deals with the objection under this Act. So and within the event of a conflict between this and the other law, this law is not national legislation, is it? What is it? What do you call it? This one. That's what you call it. Let me leave my question for now. I'll come back. Okay.
What I wanted to request is explanation of in closed term one, the meaning of only there. The reason I'm asking this question, I'm trying to play around where you say, for instance, if you say paragraph A, do not apply at the same time with paragraph B, what do you do? Do not apply consistently with paragraph B. I'm trying to understand that only. It doesn't mean, if you can actually explain.
Mr. Chair, I must apologize. Where are we in the food clause?
10.1. But the only refers to the next lines, A, B, C, C. That only refers to those situations which come under 10.1. Yeah, so what is the question?
The question I'm asking, Chair, question is that the data subject should consent to the processing. What I'm saying that processing is necessary. I'm saying if B applies and A, the data subject doesn't go to consent.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, we must read those paragraphs disjunctively to the extent that between E and F you have an or. So it means that if any one of those paragraphs are complied with, then you do have compliance. So in other words, I could possibly ask the data subject's permission or consent, then I comply with the principle, or processing is necessary for me to conclude a contract. And if that is the case, then I will also comply with
it's incredibly wide.
F is interesting, yeah.
It's processing is necessary for pursuing the legitimate interests of a responsible party or of a third party to whom the information is supplied. So particularly the third party is everybody. Then what's the point of A to E? You just have to prove F and then you're fine.
To a certain extent it is in fact so, but I think one will have to prove that it's legitimate interests. And I think that is where the difficulty will lie. I think that is the restricting factor that we have is legitimate interests. I think it's not a question of handing out information willy-nilly. I certainly don't think so.
Would it make any difference if legitimate would be replaced by legal?
I was thinking of, again, of the journalists, unfortunately, parole information, which is personal information, that gets leaked. Obviously the journalists will say it's their legitimate interest to publish that information. Or the Castor Semenya issue. I mean, they'll argue, no, it's legitimate interest. The public want to know.
I think what one must realize is, first of all, as stated before, that one must read all the principles together. That's just the first point. So if you manage, it's like a hurdles race. If you manage to get over the first hurdle, that doesn't mean that you're free. So if F is applied and you fall within F, fine. But that doesn't mean that you do not have to comply with all the others. And I think, for instance, if you look at the Semenya case, in many cases specifically will fall in terms of one of the others.
It's an or, so it's not a hurdle. You've got one of these things to overcome, that's all.
Yeah, but look, the hurdles that I'm talking about is not the hurdles in A to F, it's the hurdles of the different principles. So you have, this is now the first principle or the second principle. If you comply with F, that means you've complied with one principle, and it is true that F is very wide, but it also should be read with 2, sub 2, which says that you can at any stage indicate your object to the processing of your information in terms of F. So what it actually states there is that consent is not a prerequisite, first of all. Secondly, that we are dealing with the so-called opt-out position. And perhaps I can just, at this stage, just as a general explanation, give the difference between opt-in and opt-out, because we use that quite a lot in trying to explain some of these principles. It's actually the same thing. If you have the opt-out, people sometimes call it opt-in and opt-out consent, but I don't like to use that, because in our bill, if you talk about consent, you're talking about express consent, and there's a definition for consent as well. But sometimes in the literature, people talk about opt-in and opt-out consent. I just talk about opt-in and opt-out consent. If you have an opt-in consent, you actually ask the person's consent before you can process the information. With opt-out, you can actually process the information, and that person has to opt out of that of the position. Now, it works, for instance, if you look at direct marketing, it works in this way that you can always send information once to the person. So you, in the opt-in position, the responsibility is on the responsible party to get the consent of the person. If you send the information and you ask for the consent and that person doesn't reply, does nothing, then you do not have the consent and you cannot continue with the processing. If you, with the opt-out position, if you send the information to the person and you give the person the opportunity to opt out and the person does nothing, the responsibility is on that person to do something. And if they do not do anything, you can keep on sending them the information. And this is really what F now says. F says you can actually, you've got a very wide permission to process the information, but the responsibility is on the data subject to object against it. Had A been the only one there, if B to F did not exist, then it would have meant that the responsibility would have been on the responsible party and that you would not have been able to process the information without the consent of the subject. So this is really opt-out, an opt-out section. But I do agree that F is very wide. However, it may not cover all the instances. You may, in some instances, need the consent of the person, or it will be to your advantage to get the consent. It's not always in the data subject's interest to prescribe consent. If you think, for instance, at your if you rent a car at the airport and you get your contract, there's about 3 pages of stipulations there, and they ask you to sign here, there, where the X's are, and you just sign it, and you've signed the consent. You do not really know what you've signed. So for a data subject, consent is not that wonderful, such a wonderful thing. It's actually in to the advantage of the responsible party in many instances to give the consent of the data subject, because the data subject doesn't really have the it's not really in the data subject's interest to consent to the processing. So consent is not what we are after in this legislation.
Could I just ask Ananda's comment on this thing? Because otherwise, it's right that the journalistic thing should be in the backs of our minds, but let's just exclude it where it's not necessary. If processing here surely is not the same thing as publication. Processing is a different concept. So if, in my view, if doesn't in fact apply to publication, in any case, it was Mr. Jeffries who read if as a potentially too wide provision, given the fact that journalists may argue that it is in their legitimate interest to process information. To what degree would process in if
I mean, just on that point, I mean, before you respond, I mean, my reading is to look at the definition of processing, B, dissemination by means of transmission, distribution, or making available in any other form. So I think it's clearly publication.
I think that processing, I think it is correct that processing is a very wide term, and publication will be included in processing. And I think also that if you just look at that specific example, in that case, the journalist will be home free. But that doesn't mean that he is home free, because of the hurdles raised, and he's now past the first hurdle, there are still 7 other hurdles that he must pass, and he will fall on one of those. So just because he has passed one hurdle, because the processing is necessary for legitimate interest, he's a journalist, and he needs to do this. But remember, there are also existing laws in our country protecting privacy, like defamation and so forth. So it must also be a legitimate interest. It may not be, you know, he must still comply with the law of the country. But it may be that he will be home free insofar as the first principle is concerned. It doesn't mean that he can actually publish the information, because there are still 7 other principles to consider. But processing is certainly a very wide.
You know, what's so interesting about this, chair, with your permission, is that we're dealing with hard, pure information. And defamation is usually the issue when people have an issue with newspapers. But we're dealing here with a very interesting case where just the simple publication of the simple, hard information is the problem. It's, you know, no one has suggested that it's defamatory. And that's what makes it so important, I think. But thank you for clarifying the matter of the processing is, in fact, it does cover publication. But perhaps we...
That we should
look at the definition.
I did ask if it would make any difference for the word legitimate interest to be replaced by lawful purpose or something like that, because legitimate interest does seem to be too wide.
Yeah, because I mean, my concern is around information that was unlawfully or improperly obtained. Because remember, I mean, defamation, the defense to defamation is truth and public benefit. So if the information is true, you don't, and you can argue it's in the public benefit interest to have it, then you've got no protection. But that information may be, your medical records may be inherently personal.
I don't know. What are we doing, roughly? We try to absorb the terminologies in the... Yeah. No, that's fine. It's interesting. I think we need to break for lunch. And we should be back at 2. Before we break, maybe we should say something
else. Mr. Chief, before I forget... The thought, the example once given again, and the whole defamation concern, we must take into consideration that as far as processing of personal information is concerned, I don't think, if you could remember that slide that Ms. Lowe indicated to us, that the whole process doesn't mean that, if I may call it, as far as this is concerned, that the transgression happened at publication, but it could have been at an earlier stage as well. So that is just something that we also should take into consideration in that regard. But I would just like to maybe just mention that to us. So because it is a process, we must just keep that in mind.
That point, and I think it's from a sort of thinking about point, because I'm, as you can see, I'm particularly interested with improperly obtained information. I mean, improperly obtained evidence in court is not admissible. You know, maybe one should be moving towards a restriction on improperly obtained. So if you, Custis Amenia, if you have a leaked, I mean, this is quite drastic, but if you have a leaked medical report, you shouldn't be able to use it. And then remember, information is a bit like the toothpaste in a toothpaste tube. Once it's out, it's out. So, and there's nothing you can do to put it back in. So I'm just raising those as general concerns.
Other guys can get it back to toothpaste.
Yes.